Hey everyone, and welcome back to the First Act Podcast. I'm your host, Harry G, and today's episode is for all of you who dream of working as a talent agent. This is part two of building success as a talent agent with Joe Atamian of Wasserman. Listen in as we break down Joe's unique path discovering and developing such incredible talent as Big Gigantic, The Lumineers, and much more. This is an episode you won't want to miss.
And now, hosted by Harry G, this is your one-stop shop for hot talk straight from the top. Whether you're trying to build a job in pop, rock, or any other artsy schlock, here's your top dog with info that can't be bought, it's gotta be sought. So sit back, crack a six-pack, because we're about to chit-chat and rip facts. It's the First Act Podcast.
So I met Duffy McSwiggin, who is still with us and has made the trek through all the mergers and acquisitions, and he's at Wasserman still as well. He was in Monterey, and he must have just been promoted to agent, but he worked under Chip Hooper and then got promoted. So he was at NACA, which is the North American Campus Activities Conference. I think that's what it is. I can't remember what the acronym stands for.
Okay. So schools, like an association of like schools that were doing music shows.
Yeah. That are doing any sort of talent. Like, you know, we had a comedy department for our student union board, and it's like a trade show / dog and pony show for all the colleges around the country that book talent. So Duffy was there, and he was peddling Ari Hest, I think, was the act that he was trying to get me to book at our university. And I've told him this, so it's fine. I just kind of like kept him on the line a little bit. Like, I knew I wasn't ever going to book Ari, but why not? Just like,
why not?
It was too small for what we were doing. Like, we were looking for acts that could sell 2,000 to 3,000 tickets, like in the middle of a cornfield. So it was just didn't make sense.
Yeah.
So I kept him on the line and kept in touch with him for most of the second half of my senior year, and then graduated, and I had worked at a liquor distributor all through college. So I graduated, but also kept in touch with him after I graduated. I did the liquor sales thing for like 6 months, and then they had a job opening doing ticket counts in Monterey, which is essentially just like, you know, calling the promoters and seeing how many tickets have sold for each show. And I did that for like the whole MPA roster. It's a soul sucking gig.
often at agencies, you're just ticket counts at agencyname.com. You don't even have your own email
account. I know. We were very progressive. I had my own email. I had a name, which was nice. So started out there doing ticket counts. What's that?
For how long?
So I started there in February of 07. I probably did it for a year. And then...
And you moved for this job? You moved out to Monterey for this job?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think?
They were fine with it. I mean, it was kind of like, yeah, sure, go try. Well, you know, like it wasn't like, we know you can do it. It was like, go give it a shot.
Okay. So I'm starting to understand where all this imposter syndrome is coming from.
It's like, go give it a shot. Okay. No, it was good though. I think they knew if they told me that, you know, don't go try this, I still would have gone and done it. So,
yeah. All right. So you're doing ticket counts for about a year. And the cool thing with ticket counts is you're interacting with a lot of concert promoters.
Yes. Yes. And so, yeah, you know, like got to get on the phone with a lot of them. Thankfully, our system was somewhat automated where I could like blast out a bunch of emails at one time. But so Jeffrey Hassan, who works at UTA now, was Jonathan Levine's assistant in Monterey. He got promoted to agent and moved to our Nashville office. So then I was working as an assistant for Jonathan Levine. And I don't know if you know Jonathan or have ever talked to him.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Tell us about Jonathan.
I mean, he's great. Super intense dude. He ended up, it's a very long story, but like basically ended up shredding his knee skiing and had all these complications. So like was basically out of the office for like a year, like really out of the office, like should have died basically, like pulmonary embolisms and all this stuff. So like,
that was a really bad accident.
Yeah, it wasn't so much a bad accident. I think it was just a bad surgery.
That's unfortunate.
But so I was his assistant for like 6 months and then he was out for like a year. And I always joke with him, like, dude, if you were around, I would have gotten fired. Like, I would have been a horrible assistant, like absolutely terrible assistant. And that's just, I just know that about myself. But Jonathan's still like one of my biggest mentors. And like, he's still in Nashville. He moved to Nashville.
Who was on his roster?
So like when I was coming up with him, he was doing the Black Eyed Peas, like when they were really popping off. He did The Dead, you know, he did a lot of the offshoots of all the Grateful Dead stuff, did Phil and Friends and Bob Weir, and still worked with them, you know. And you know, I think he was working with Live at the time. You know, he's been in it for a while and done very well. Very smart man. But he moved to Nashville, and then I was promoted and stayed in Monterey for a couple years, 2 or 3 years, I think, and then ended up going to Nashville as well.
What prompted you going to Nashville? Because like everyone thinks like California is like such a music hub.
Yeah, I mean Monterey's not.
I mean, I wasn't gonna say it.
Yeah, it's Dan and Fred, like they definitely had it down. They knew what they were doing. So I can't remember where Dan and Fred started their career, but they were basically like, we don't dig the LA vibe. And you know, Monterey, like back in the day, it was like Monterey Pop Festival and a bunch of fucking hippies and Big Sur, like. So they're like, we're going to go put our office here. And then they did that for like the next 40 years.
So, they loved it. So,
they did it and they did it very well. You know, they were like the crown jewel of the independent booking agency forever until Paradigm scooped them up. But yeah, Monterey, it's just tough, man. Like it's tough travel with how much travel we do to like, it's a 2-hour drive to San Francisco. It's an hour plus to San Jose. You know, like if you're going to fly anywhere, Monterey has an airport, but there's so much fog that if you don't take the first flight of the day when the plane is at, you know, the plane will be there, then you're getting delayed. And like, it was just impossible to travel out of, which was a big part of it. And then also there's no local scene there. And I mean, a very good example of this is when I first found the Lumineers, Marco, who books Hotel Cafe in LA, still the only thing he's ever sent me. He's like, there's this great band came through last night. He's like, they're in San Francisco tonight. You got to go check them out. And it was like a Tuesday. And I'm like, am I really going to go spend 4 hours in the car, 2 hours each way to go see this band for 30 minutes? And like, I almost didn't go. Like,
yeah.
And I wouldn't have signed the band, like, you know.
And how small were they?
There was 15 people there.
That's wild. And so what did you see in that show that made you want to sign them? Like, how did you approach them afterwards? Like, how does that go? Like, what goes on in your head when you see them? There's 15 people there. And then how do you then go up to them afterwards and say, hey, I'm so-and-so, an agent at this agency. I want to sign you.
Well, you know, it's funny. I haven't really had to do that a whole lot. They had a manager. So I got in touch with the manager. I let her know that before the show.
Yeah.
Let her know that I was coming. She let them know that I was coming. So like, it wasn't like some weird dude walking up to him after the show and be like, I'm going to make you a star, you know? So
I think a lot of the listeners think it's like that. That's why it's important to go through this exercise.
Yeah. I mean, there are instances of that, like talking about Sturgill Simpson, like, and Jonathan Levine, who we work on Sturgill together, but Jonathan found him like you know, he was playing like an opening slot at the Basement in Nashville, was outside talking to somebody and heard Sturgill singing and was like, hold on, I got to go see what this is. And like, basically, like, he jokes that he did this, but he went up to him and like dropped a card in his like guitar case, you know? So like that kind of stuff does happen. But usually not, it's not, usually there's some sort of, you know, at least heads up from someone that like, we're coming to see the show and we want to talk kind of thing.
Relationships business. All right. Yeah. So you go to the show. So, okay. So you message the manager. Who's the manager? Is it the same manager now or no?
No, it was Kristen Green. So she was based up in Seattle at the time. Yeah.
Was she independent or was she working with a company?
She was independent. Yeah, we'll say independent. She had a company with another person in Seattle.
But not like Red or
it wasn't a big management company.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, let her know I was going to be coming to the show. Saw the show. It was great. I mean, it was super engaging. I think the biggest thing was like they played like they were playing to a stadium. You know, like that was, I think, the thing that kind of stuck with me was just like, they just went for it, you know, and their whole thing early on from playing like open mic nights and like opening slots and things like that was that, you know, they would get down into the crowd and like force people to pay attention. And they had no idea it was me, but like during one of their songs, I can't remember which song it was, they got down into the crowd and they like literally just made a circle around me and like were singing a song. And then afterwards, Jer was like, oh my God. He's like, I can't believe that was you. Like, that's so embarrassing. Like, I swear to God, we didn't know it was you when we did that. But it was funny. It was, you know, it was a great show.
But that makes people feel special. And yeah, that's how, because that's what the fans want. They want to be connected with the art. They want to be connected with the artists. And if an artist takes that extra step to do that, I think that, I guess that's what you see. That's what helps shine through.
Yeah. And you know, the getting down into the crowd, like they've talked about this in interviews. It was more a function of just getting people to pay attention, you know, when you're playing something that, you know, people might not be there to see you. It just was like a way for them to get in people's faces and be like, hey, fuckers, there's a show going on here.
Yeah. stop just talking.
Right.
All right, cool. So, okay. So the show ends. I presume you had a good time because they embarrassed the shit out of you.
Yeah.
in front of 14 of your peers. Not even your peers, just 14 other people.
Right.
And then you went up to, what did you say her name was? Karen?
Kristen. She wasn't at the show, actually, though. No.
Oh, no?
No.
Did she at least guest list you?
I'm sure she did.
Yeah. All right. So did you meet the band after the show or you hit her up afterwards?
No, I met the band after the show, like pretty briefly, like, you know, just like, hey, you know, I know Kristen told you about me and like, love the show. Let's talk, yada, yada, yada. And then I think I had like probably one other conversation with them before I started working with them.
Wow. And so you just, it just felt like a good fit.
Yeah, totally.
How many acts did you have signed at this point?
Well, so that's funny. I was just going to bring that up. So I had started working with Big Gigantic the year prior and it had been going really well. And I think that kind of offered me a lot of leeway as far as signing goes, because, you know, when you first get moved to agent, there's a lot of times you'll kind of have the reins on a little bit. It's like the company doesn't want you to go out and sign 25 things that all have 15 people at their shows. So I didn't ever get any pushback on it. Everybody really liked the music. So yeah, I think I was lucky in that regard in that the one act that I had started working with had done pretty well out of the gate.
And was Big Gigantic around the same size when you had discovered them?
It was probably a little bit bigger, and I saw them at a festival. I think I saw them at Camp Bisco, and yeah, they were probably doing a couple hundred people in a few spots by the time Jason Kupperman and I came on board, who we still work together on Big G.
I think Jason represented Busty in the Bass. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Because they formed at my alma mater. I remember they used to play like jazz music when we'd have like business networking events.
Oh my God.
Before Busty and the Bass was like actually like a band. And one of my friends from college manages them. So it's a small world.
It is a very small industry.
Yeah. So it was kind of funny. I'm sure you can imagine like me at like a Wine and Cheese, like shaking hands with people, and Busty's just there playing like a little bit of like jazz music.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. Yeah. I had the guys in Big Gigantic play the jazz happy hour at my wedding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
But actually I'll give credit where credit is due. Jason found Big Gigantic. He just hadn't been promoted to agent yet. So it was like this little, like, you know, he's like, you're allowed to sign things. It's like, you should sign this. And then when I become an agent, we'll do it together. I'm like, all right, yeah, that sounds great. I love the music.
And that's so, just like a handshake deal. And like, I mean, cause at the end of the day, cause you sign them and it's your name there as agent, but I guess you guys are just working it together. Was he your assistant?
No, mm-mm. We came up as assistants at the same time. So like we were roommates in Monterey, and you know, we were basically on the same directory. I think he became an agent like 6 months later.
Okay.
So we knew it was coming. We just didn't want to let the acts get away, you know, waiting for the official wings to go sign stuff.
That's cool. All right. So now you've got two good bands under your belt. And so what did you do with the Lumineers to make them successful?
I mean, it blew up pretty quick. I mean, as far as, you know, they put out a great first record, like that had a lot to do with it. Got a bunch of radio play. I think on the touring front, we were pretty smart with them. You know, we left a lot on the table as far as ticket sales goes. It's and really built like this kind of fever pitch demand at shows.
How do you do that?
What's that?
How do you do that?
Just play a venue that's maybe a little bit smaller than you should be playing.
Mm-hmm. So that they're sold out, so that there's, so people, yeah. So that when they come back, people, you create a little bit more urgency for people to buy those tickets.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's just a better vibe, right? Like there's a better energy playing a sold out show than playing a show that's two thirds or three quarters of the way full.
Right.
And I think it's stuck with a lot of people as far as like their first show and then just the energy that was associated with those. And we had some great, you know, we got them on some great support looks out of the gate. They did a summer. I'm trying to think, the summer after their first record came out, we had them out with Old Crow Medicine Show. And we did some days with Brandi Carlile. And then that, excuse me, that December, we did a run of arena dates with Dave Matthews Band. And so it was like, it was just kind of, everything was just kind of popping in place, you know, the way it needs to.
And so how do you then pitch your act to some of these bigger acts? So you must have good relationships with other agencies, or were they all under MPA?
It was all in house.
Okay.
So that was helpful. That was helpful. Okay. You know, and there's not a ton, you know, in the world today, as far as music releases go and things like that, like it's a lot different, I feel like. But that was kind of like a moment in time, you know, with the Mumford thing happening, and like then these guys kind of came up right after that, where there's not any thing that is like really in this world, or, you know, the live show has taken a completely different life of its own. But back then, like the super straight ahead folk world that is worth tickets and has a lot of heat, that would be an opening act. So I feel like we were turning down more support opportunities than we were going after. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's funny. There was a big article in Polestar just came out today about like the whole decade that we've done with Lumineers, but it talks about it in that article as well, is that when I went to Charlottesville to see them open for Dave Matthews Band. And, you know, Charlottesville is like, Dave Matthews is the second coming in Charlottesville. And I went there and they just blew the roof off the place as an opening act. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, these guys can do arenas. Like, yeah, it could get there. It translates. So it was good to see that. And Wes and Jer have talked about that. And then further down the line, we had them open for U2 and Tom Petty in stadiums, different tours. But it was the same kind of thing. It's like, oh, these guys can play baseball stadiums. Like it still translates. And Wes and Jer have talked about how important that was, like even for their own, you know, self, I don't want to say ego because it's not ego, but like their own validation that like, oh, we can play these big stages. Like it's doable and people are reacting.
And in order for you to make this happen, like what is important for you to have set in place so that, you know, when they're ready for stadiums, like you're ready to pull the trigger? Cause you have to get ahead of it, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at this level now we're, you know, a year plus out, you know, talking about what we're doing. At that point, it was, you know, everybody, we were really just trying to kind of hang on for dear life on that first record. But like, you know, these were guys and gals that were playing, you know, open mic nights like a year before. And then they're like opening for Dave Matthews Band and arenas. And a big part of it was like, we had to like look the part, you know, like we can't just get up there with like our instruments and just kind of, you know, you can't get in the crowd and get in every, you know, 12,000 people's faces at one time.
Right.
So like the production aspect was like a big conversation on that first record. And we brought in a couple seasoned veterans to kind of consult on everything, you know, Richard Glasgow, who does Fish, and John Warren, who's been around forever on the production side, to just like really try to dial it in and make it seem like, you know, these guys have been doing this for 10 years kind of thing. And it, you know, it worked pretty well.
That's cool. All right. So production can really go a long way and people don't even notice it. I mean, like, of course they notice the production, but what I'm saying is like from the fans' perspective, they don't notice that like the production is such a huge element, or it can be such a huge element for some of these bands.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like it's one of those things when it's like an agent, you know, it's like when the job is done well, you don't notice it kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
But if, you know, if they would have gotten up there and played in the same way and configuration and with the same kind of production that they had been playing in the 500 cap clubs, like people would have noticed, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm sure nobody noticed because it was done right.
Exactly. Cool.
Yeah.
What makes a good agent?
Oh boy. So the answer I always give to this is, and the question that I kind of play off is like, what experience prepared you to be a good agent? Mm-hmm. And the answer I always give is my high school had a peer mediator program. So basically like two kids get in a fight, instead of going to the principal, they go to another classmate who's a peer mediator and they come to some sort of resolution. So I was a peer mediator in high school.
Of course.
Dealing.
You were dealing the jock who loved music.
Dealing with people in the music industry is like being a peer mediator in high school. There's a lot of egos and, you know, you just got to try to make everybody happy. And I feel like, you know, a good agent is able to get things to a point where everyone feels okay about the outcome.
It's like, all right, guys, shake hands. We've got to get back to math class.
Right. 100%.
Everyone feels okay about the outcome.
Yeah. If everyone's a little pissed about how the deal is done, then it's probably a good deal.
That's funny. I like that. I like that. We're going to use that for our TikTok promos.
All right. There we go.
So for all the high school students out there, if you want to be a good agent, start being that peer mediator.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
All right.
That's the best practice I ever had.
So I want to, I know I want to still be a little cognizant of our time here, because I know that we have a hard stop at, you know, in about 20 minutes, but I've got a question for you about more like Web3 stuff.
Yeah. So, which is not my forte at all.
That's perfect.
Okay.
I mean, I don't really think there's many people in the music industry that have a forte in Web3, to be fair. Now, why is Web3 not your forte? Are you just not interested in it? Do you think that it has a place in the music industry, or like not really?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. Like with the crazy NFT stuff that we saw during the pandemic, like it feels like that bubble's kind of burst a little bit. Well, not a little bit, it has. You know, whereas it was just like a gold rush and everybody was like, gimme, 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 gimme. And then it's like, oh, people don't actually want this. So like it's tough to say in my mind, to be honest.
Thanks for tuning in to part two. Stay tuned for part three. Remember, new episodes release every Thursday at 12 p.m. Pacific. See you there.